Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We got the latest figures on economic growth today. They were fine, lower than expected. Part of what happened? Not enough government spending. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, everybody, the 25th of February. Good, as always, to have you with us. We got a government economic report today that is officially called the National Income and Product Accounts Fourth Quarter Second Estimate. More simply, it's a revised look at gross domestic product September through New Year's. And it turns out that economic growth at the end of last year wasn't all it was cracked up to be. The early estimate for the last quarter of 2010 was for a growth rate of 3.2%, which would have been pretty darn nice. Today, the Commerce Department dialed that back to a more normal 2.8% rise. And it turns out one of the things still dragging on the recovery was lower government spending, especially at the state and local level. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, explains.
Even with today's downward revision, all-important consumer spending remains strong. But it's just as consumers finally seem to be picking up the slack that lawmakers across the nation are engaging in the battle over spending cuts.
This is the wheel that's squeaking the loudest right now.
David Weiss is chief economist at Standard & Poor's. He says reductions in government purchases could cost the country half a percentage point in economic growth this year.
State and local governments actually spend more than the federal government. It's all the teachers, the police. This is over 10% of GDP.
Purchases and investments by state and local governments fell by almost 2.5% at the end of last year compared to the same quarter in 2009. Weiss says this is happening earlier than expected, but that's not necessarily worrisome. In fact, he suggests it could be a good thing.
Look, the sooner you make cuts, the easier they are to make. If you make the cuts now, they won't have to be as drastic, hopefully, down the road as they would otherwise.
Just how significant this will be to the overall economy is a subject of some debate. At MF Global, chief economist James O'Sullivan points out federal help to state and local governments is just now running out.
At this point, we're pretty much at the peak for federal grants and aid as a result of the fiscal stimulus package. So we will see a decline clearly over the next few quarters.
But O'Sullivan also notes that as those training wheels fall away, the economy is picking up some speed.
Tax receipts have already started to accelerate. In fact, tax receipts are up about 5% year over year right now for state and local governments. And as the economy continues to improve, as we expect it will, if anything, those tax receipts should strengthen some more.
Well, Sullivan says he's hopeful that will be enough to offset the end of emergency federal support. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Speaking of things dragging on the economy, and we'll get to this in the weekly wrap in just a bit, oil rose a tad today, about $98 a barrel or so at the close of New York. Google has made some changes to the way it computes search results. The company is bumping what it calls low-quality websites that are clogging up the web down lower in its search algorithms. And as happens every single time you mention Google and search in the same breath, there are billions of dollars on the line. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Companies spend millions to get their web pages to rise to the top of Google's search results. And Google is constantly tweaking its algorithms so you can't game the system. Usually, these tweaks are small. This latest one is not. Matt Cutts leads Google's anti-spam web team.
So about 12% of queries are affected to a degree that a regular user might notice.
What does that mean? Hundreds of millions of useless search results should disappear.
A lot of people want to turn this into something adversarial or want us to call out specific companies, and that's not our intent. Our intent is just to try to find the best results for our users.
In the past few years, several so-called content farms have blossomed into multi-billion dollar businesses. They did it by pumping out millions of evergreen articles designed to pop to the top of Google's search results. Cutts won't name names, but many media analysts point to one firm in particular, Demand Media. These are the folks who created eHow and Livestrong. Today, if you want to remove a red wine stain or ripen an avocado, eHow has literally dozens of articles aimed at you. Co-founder Richard Rosenblatt explained his business this way on an earnings call this week.
Demand connects millions of people with diverse needs and interests to the useful, valuable, and relevant information they want.
And advertisers love this stuff. When you click on one of these articles, advertisers know exactly what you're looking for. But many critics say the actual information is often second rate, and hundreds of eHow articles vanished from the top spot on Google searches today. Still, Demand Media issued a statement saying Google's changes hadn't affected its overall traffic. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Traders must have gotten used to $100 barrel oil. I don't know. All three major indices finished a bad week strong today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Most of the attention being paid the Middle East and North Africa today is still on Libya. The White House announced unilateral sanctions this afternoon. The United Nations is debating a resolution calling what's happening there crimes against humanity. But in fact, there have been protests all over the region on this Friday, from Iraq to Bahrain, Jordan, and Tunisia. Here to talk about some of what's fueling those demonstrations is writer and commentator Reza Aslan. Reza, welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks. It's nice to be back on the show.
These protests today and the past month and a half in the Middle East are certainly about democracy and for freedom. They want an end to corruption. But I wonder if it's not also a larger call for more basic needs, for more basic wants.
At its core, whether you're talking about Libya or Tunisia or Yemen or Egypt, this is about the growing economic disparity between the haves and have-nots. But make no mistake, this is a region in which economics and politics are intimately connected. And so when you're calling for greater political participation, that cannot be excised from the demand for greater economic rights.
In the middle term, though, Reza, what do they want? If in the short term they want some kind of reform that's tangible, and in the longer, final term they want, one assumes, democracy, what's that middle ground?
I guess the best way to put the middle ground is that they want the same kind of access to the economic opportunities that they see the people in positions of power having. Now, that may be a pipe dream. However, there is an opportunity here for the West, and particularly for the United States. As you know, Kai, we've been sending $2 billion a year to Egypt, primarily so that it can buy the tanks, the guns, the tear gas, and the bullets that it's used to create one of the most oppressive police states in the region. What if we change course now and instead begin to directly invest in the civic infrastructure and the economic infrastructure of Egypt? Then we have an opportunity not only to create a much more stable region, but we can reframe the perceptions that Egyptians have of the United States. Indeed, we could change the very relationship between the Arab world and America.
You read the papers, though, right? About the only thing that Americans agree on that ought to be cut from the budget these days is foreign aid and foreign assistance.
That's true, but let's be honest. The $2 billion that we give to Egypt, the $1 billion that we give to Jordan, and the $3 billion that we give to Israel, nothing's going to happen to that money. It's still going to continue to be funneled into the militaries of these countries.
There's a question to be asked here about frustration, and you alluded to it a moment ago. How long will it take for people in the Middle East, whether they're in Egypt or Bahrain or even in Libya, to become frustrated with the messiness of economic liberalization once it eventually happens? I mean, they've been politically frustrated. Economic frustration is another thing entirely.
I think you're absolutely right. But again, I think this is where the West can really come in and play the role of the savior. We had nothing to do with these revolutions. These were homegrown revolutions by people who were demanding the most basic rights of dignity. But now that that transition has begun, there is a role for the Western world to make sure that the enthusiasm for political participation doesn't give way to the inevitable frustration with the slow rate of economic process that everyone knows is to be expected.
Reza Aslan. His book is called No God But God. He's also the founder of AslanMedia.com. Reza, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
The big international story the past month or so really started to hit home economically just this week as crude oil bumped up against $100 a barrel. And so that is where we will begin our weekly wrap. Lee Gallagher is here from Fortune Magazine, also John Carney from CNBC. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
All right, got to start with oil, $100 a barrel. Lee, how long can we take that without doing damage to the economy?
The thing with oil is that this is something we've been through before. Unlike everything else that we've seen in the past 2 to 3 years, we know what oil shocks mean. We know how bad it is. And don't forget, it wasn't so long ago that oil was $140 a barrel back in 2008. So this, I mean, I don't want to say this is no big deal, but this is something we can overcome.
All right, but wait a second. $147, John Carney, there is a school of thought that says part of what happened to get us into this recession was oil at $147 a barrel.
That's right. If oil goes high enough, it can put a big hole in the economy. People stop driving. They stop buying cars. They stop going out to eat. It can really hurt things. But I'm told that $100 a barrel of oil is not a crisis. It's when it gets up to the $120, $125 marker that people's behavior really changes. And that's when you can push things right back into a recession.
Fair enough. Let me turn to the GDP numbers out this morning. We heard Bob Moon telling us a little bit earlier that part of what happened was that states are cutting their spending. And as we're seeing in Wisconsin and a whole bunch of other states, Lee, that's only going to continue. So where are we on the deficit curve, if you will, in this economy?
Well, I mean, the state issue is huge, and it's states, it's municipalities. So there are many, many individual problems, individual crises that are happening right now. Wisconsin actually is in much better shape than a lot of other states and municipalities, leading one to believe that is more of a power play or a sort of surgical attack on public sector unions.
Yeah.
But the one thing it is doing, though, is bringing this into the limelight. So, you know, you have to think other states and municipalities are going to try a lot harder to curb things and start bargaining and start negotiating to, you know, have unions maybe make more concessions so that it doesn't get to that point.
John, I wanted to ask you about something you've been writing a lot about this week, and Lee picked up on it a little bit. Municipalities, muni bonds and state borrowing and the, I don't know, is crisis too strong a word there?
The people who work in muni bonds tell me, no, this isn't a crisis. Everything will be fine. The market's in a little bit of a panic. But look, historically, defaults don't really happen. We think, you know, this is a good buying opportunity. The thing is, that's what I heard from the mortgage people back in 2006. And I think it's terrifying that there's so much complacency within the fund manager world about what's going on in muni bonds. Investors we're on week 14 now, have keep taking money every week out of muni bond funds. So what these guys, the managers, are saying is, oh, no, we're smarter than all those people and we're smarter than the market and we can outthink things. And this is a great opportunity for us. I don't know that things will blow up, but I do know that things are a lot more fragile than these guys are letting on.
Well, on that word fragile, Lee, let me ask you to reconcile something for me. Oil at $100 a barrel. The economy is still shaky, as we saw with the GDP number this morning. And yet consumer confidence somehow is at 3-year highs.
Well, you know, don't forget, we are in a recovery. We have been in a recovery since, well, it depends if you talk about the financial economy or the rest of the economy, but we've basically been in a recovery since last August. And those kinds of indicators have been getting better. I mean, there are bumps in the road. There are oil prices, which, by the way, have been going up for 6 months, not just since the Middle East crisis. There are, obviously, the jobs hangover is a huge cloud hanging over everything, but consumers are starting to feel better. They're starting to see that things are better. Many of them don't think their own personal situation is better, but things are moving along in the right direction.
Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine, John Carney from CNBC. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
Coming up,
there are 3 billion fish in the ocean. They're looking for one. Finding Nemo.
The changing soundtrack of movie previews, but first, let's do the numbers. An encouraging bump in consumer confidence, as Lee Gallagher was just talking about, helped boost investor confidence today. Lifted the Dow 61 points, about a half percent, 12,130 at the bell. The NASDAQ bounced 43 points higher, more than 1.5%, 2781 there. The S&P 500 added 13 points, better than 1%, 1319 is the number you're looking for. You are hearing the happy music, but it was actually an unhappy week for stocks. The Dow fell more than 2%. The NASDAQ was off just shy of 2% for the week. The S&P 500 lost 1.7%, breaking its three-week winning stretch, had you been keeping track. Intel gained the most among the blue chips. An analyst upgrade helped boost the chipmaker stock by nearly 3%. Boeing was still getting some lift from its winning the contract for the Air Force's new tanker program. The jetmaker stock climbed more than 2% today. The turmoil in Libya sent investors back to the more secure haven of U.S. Treasuries. Bond prices rose again. That pushed the yield down on the 10-year T-note even lower, 3.41%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for January. The National Association of Realtors releases its pending home sales index for December. And the annual TED Conference gets underway in Long Beach, California, with the theme, The Rediscovery of Wonder. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Angelina Jolie's spy thriller Salt isn't going to be a big winner Sunday night at the Academy Awards, mostly because it wasn't nominated in any of the big categories. Salt does top another list, though, one of more dubious distinction. It was the riskiest film of 2010. Risky to make, risky to finance, and risky to insure. Lauren Bailey's the Vice President of Entertainment at Fireman's Fund Insurance. They provide coverage for a lot of movies. Lauren, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's start with Angelina Jolie and Salt. And what made it the riskiest film to insure this year?
Well, it was risky because Ms. Jolie decided to do her own stunts. And obviously, there's always risk when an actor decides to do something like that.
Does she get to just decide that, or is it a consultation with obviously the production company, but also, I imagine, you guys, right?
It is. You know, we try to certainly stay in the background and not interfere, but they obviously want to know our opinion and how we'd feel about something like that.
Moving beyond Salt, what were some other films out last year that were, you know, they got shot, but they were risky to do?
Well, anything that's action, that has a lot of stunt, that might have pyrotechnics, where they're actually filming as opposed to using special effects, those productions tend to have the largest risk. You know, things that are romantic comedies, for example, tend to be fairly low risk.
Yeah, I'm guessing like The King's Speech didn't have a whole lot of insurance risk.
Exactly, right. Exactly.
Is there a way for me to know as a viewer sort of what's a risky production element and which is not, other than the obvious explosions and you know, pyrotechnics?
Probably one of the things that people might not think about is just kind of the overall budget of the production. So a lot of times you'll see in the press how big a movie is. For us, those can be the largest risk, because if a production goes down on a given day, regardless of what it is.
And when you say go down, that means stops filming, right?
Exactly. So that could result in, you know, as much as, you know, a stunt that goes bad.
So you guys probably had to swallow pretty hard when you decided to let Angelina Jolie jump off that moving train or whatever. But can you think of an instance when you just said, nuh-uh, forget it? This is too dangerous. We're not insuring.
You know, for the most part, what happens in those kinds of scenarios is that we're negotiating. So what we might say is, for example, we have to carry a different deductible, or maybe we're going to exclude injury resulting from a specific activity or something like that. But, you know, then they can determine that, okay, you know what, as long as we have insurance for everything else, we'll go ahead and take that risk ourselves.
This is probably one of those hush-hush things that nobody in Hollywood likes to talk about. But there is, I imagine, somewhere in each studio and in each insurance company, a list of actors and actresses and directors who are, well, notorious, frankly, for causing problems and making insurability difficult.
That would be a fair statement.
And that's about as far as you're going to go on that.
Yeah, that's pretty much as far as I'm going to go on that.
Lauren Bailey, she runs the entertainment division at Fireman's Fund, the insurance company. Lauren, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I was thinking of Charlie Sheen when I asked that question. Lindsay Lohan, too. Here's some disclosure. Fireman's Fund is owned by Allianz, the big financial services company, which is an underwriter of this broadcast. Spare a thought now for the trailers that helped get people into movie theaters in the first place. For a long time, you knew what was coming even before the lights went down. A deep, almost thundering voice walking you, the humble viewer, through whatever the storyline happened to be. Those voiceovers are largely gone now, partly out of necessity, but also partly because studios think they found a better way to sell their product. Ashley Milne-Tite has more.
For more than 20 years, one man was the voice of most movie trailers.
Once, he was programmed to destroy the future. Now, his mission...
Get down!
...is to protect it.
Voiceover king Don LaFontaine narrated thousands of trailers until his death in 2008. Matt Brubaker is head of the theatrical division at creative agency Trailer Park. He says studios saw LaFontaine's rich tones as a key marketing tool.
When I started making trailers, you know, there was a lot of research that people, for the most part, got so used to Don's voice that they didn't feel it was a big or important movie if his voice wasn't associated with it.
But that was in the 90s. Brubaker says in the last decade, new technology has led to much more sophisticated editing techniques. Most trailers now use super quick cuts, graphics, and actor dialogue to tell the story.
We're getting married in 5 hours.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
If the narrative's become passé, perhaps I can let the rest of this story tell itself. Here's Matt Brubaker again.
Now, the viewer is so much more aware of movie trailers. They're television shows about movie trailers. They're on the internet. They can see them and they analyze them almost as entertainment content themselves.
My name is Ryan Parsons. I am the owner of TrailerAddict.com. I really think the voiceover became almost a parody of itself, where it's just so easy to spot it and get distracted by it and see how this voice is trying to control your emotion on the film it's showing. All you need is good editing and a song that like kind of draws people in. I made a couple examples is the first and second trailer for Where the Wild Things Are, and they use the song Wake Up by Arcade Fire. It worked both ways. You love the song, but at the same time the song fit the movie so well, you immediately were kind of attached to what this movie was showing.
My name is Andy Geller. I've been a voice actor since the early 90s. For years I did Disney stuff, a lot of early Pixar movies. There are 3 billion fish in the ocean. They're looking for one. Finding Nemo. Special effects has just advanced so far in the past several years. I think they can do things with visuals that cause a narrator at times to be... I think they feel that it's not necessary.
Okay, I can't let the story finish without popping back in. I have to ask, does Andy Geller lament the absence of a narrator?
No, I don't. I only lament when I do hear a voiceover on a trailer and it's not me.
Still, Geller stays busy and well-paid, narrating TV and DVD versions of trailers and many other promos. He even does the occasional favor.
That was Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on a Friday, a chance to get away from the real news and find out what didn't quite make the headlines. It all happens courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Francis Newnham, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Jennifer Collins, reporter, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
So, Blockbuster, you know, it filed for bankruptcy, and apparently it still owes a lot of the movie studios a ton of money, millions of dollars, right?
All right.
So to get their money back, the movie studios are basically saying, pay us these fees, Or at least could you please just give the DVDs back?
So wait, Blockbuster is being hounded to pay fees and return videos?
It's kind of karmic, is it not?
Revenge is sweet.
Adrian Hill, sustainability reporter for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, in England right now, they're cutting the budget. But in England, there's this big fight over what's a job and what's a non-job.
What is a non-job?
Well, newspapers are calling these non-jobs, and there are things like walking coordinator, roller disco coach, cheerleading development officer, and bouncy castle attendant, which I would just like to submit my application for.
I support bouncy castles, but I do think you could probably get volunteers for cheerleader development coaching. I was just a guess.
You could be right.
Ethan Lindsay, Morning Report producer, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm going to talk about the robot marathon. It's the first ever in Japan, and I can't even say those words without smiling. The robot marathon.
It's actually robots, like, running to beat each other?
A bunch of robots running 26.2 miles. They're doing it in tandem with the Tokyo marathon that actual humans run in. 4 days, robots running in a big circle.
This is actually, you know, I think, smart for humanity, because whatever robot wins, that's the one we destroy.
Get it out of the way first.
But I've seen the Terminator. Let's nip this thing in the bud.
Call that just a taste of what Rico and Brendan have to offer. They do a podcast. It's called The Dinner Party Download, and there's a link to it on our website, marketplace.org. And with that, we're out of here. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow picked up 61 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ added 43 points, more than 1.5%. The S&P 500 grew by 13 points, better than 1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson, the executive producer of the program. Is J.J. Yule. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, you've probably thought about where you want your kids to go to college, right? But what about what they want?
Finally, my son said, look, what I want to do is go to a school where I can take my shirt off, paint my chest in the school colors, and major in beer.
I don't know. It worked out all right for me. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.